I get it. Good afternoon, everyone. We're at the Wives Farm Sale. Today is February 18th? February 18th, 2018. And we're here for a book launch of my new book, Search Engine Volume 1. And I'd like to thank Yaakov Ellis and Shoshana Araman from the Farm Sale and everyone else who helped put all this together. And Alec Goldstein was here, publisher of Kodesh Press. Alec is the brains behind the book, so I thank you very much. So what I'd like to talk about today, in the short time that we have, are three things. First, I'd like to explain why you should buy the book, even though it's all available. You can read it all for free online. And then I'd like to talk about social media and Jewish thought and Jewish law, briefly. Big topic. Obviously, we can't cover everything. So first, I'd just like to give you a little history about myself. My name is Gil Student. In 2004, I started a blog when blogs were just getting going. And the reason I started the blog, just minor trivia, is that someone in the conservative movement had started a blog where he was writing about halacha, and I thought he was wrong on so many areas that I felt I needed to argue. Now, the way a blog works is that the hierarchy is that the person in charge is the person who runs the blog, and then people write comments on the bottom. And I felt that if I argued from a lower hierarchy, I was already starting at a disadvantage. So instead, I started my own blog, and then we went back and forth. The topics, by the way, the subject was homosexuality and halacha. And in those days, 2004, so there was a clear Orthodox position and a clear conservative position. Now, the world has changed a little bit, but I still maintain there's a clear Orthodox position and a clear conservative position. So I was writing it, keep maintaining it for quite a few years. 2013, I switched it to an online magazine. So what's the difference between a blog and an online magazine? So number one is now I now have an editorial board that reviews anything controversial and helps with decisions on material. Number two, I believe the quality of writing has increased. It's not more just me talking about my own personal feelings on halacha. It's multiple writers talking seriously about serious issues. And number three is comments. So in a blog, the comments are a way to create discussion. Blogs are mostly about the discussion, and there's a very lively, hopefully in a good blog, back and forth on subjects, on topics. And that's the social media aspect of blogs, people talking to each other, creating a community, creating a conversation. On a magazine, you don't really have that. You have, the way I look at it in a magazine, I allow comments on the bottom, but they must be written like a letter to the editor, or I will edit them to look like a letter to the editor, which means no, just random thoughts. You got to think it through. Your presenting information has to be relevant, and it has to add to the conversation, and add information that is verifiable, not just I seem to remember once hearing. So I believe that increases the value of comments that people leave, because they are edited and they are considered, they are fact-checked to some degree, and they therefore are more reliable. Although never rely on anything you see on the internet, this you can not rely on less. So 2013, if you do the math, it's 4 years to 2017. So Alec worked with me to take 4 years of essays from Torah Musings, the website, and to turn them into three books. This is the first of the three books. This one is about Jewish life. Next, God willing, will be about Jewish leadership, and the third should be about Jewish thought. So what does Jewish life mean? It means halacha. That's a fancy way of saying it's essays on halacha. So what I like to write when I write about halacha is issues about the conflict between tradition and modernity. How do we take this halacha that was originally put down in writing 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, and then was codified, let's say, 1,000 years ago, and 500 years ago, how do we apply it today in the 21st century? And it's not like I'm making this stuff up. It's been written about a lot. But what I do is I take it and I put it into English, and I summarize it and put some framework around it, discussing things of how does a halacha evolve over time? Now, when you talk about the evolution of halacha, you're talking about a dangerous area over there, because some people like to say, well, halacha changes to whatever we want it to be. Whatever society wants, halacha will adjust to whatever the current views are. I don't see halacha that way. I don't think that's an orthodox view. I think the traditional orthodox view is as follows. There are debates about halacha. There are a lot of things that we just don't have certainty about. But over time, sometimes those debates are settled, and you have a precedent that creates a baseline, and everything beyond that is built on that. And that is how I see halacha evolving. So, for example, umbrellas and Shabbos. Nobody today in the Orthodox community will open up an umbrella or carry an open umbrella on Shabbos outside, even if you have an area you're allowed to carry. Umbrellas are not allowed. So why is that? It's actually not so clear. There was a big debate about that in the 1800s, a little bit in the 1700s, and the conclusion was, for better or for worse, you're not allowed to open it. Now, it's actually not so clear that it's usur, and there are borderline cases that are very interesting about, let's say, so one case that came up is a doctor had to visit a patient on Shabbos. Wasn't urgent, but he had to get there sometime that day. Pouring rain. Should he walk with an umbrella, or should he ask a non-Jew to drive him in a horse and buggy wagon? Horse and buggy wagon is explicitly rabbinically forbidden. Umbrella, is that biblically forbidden? Is it rabbinically forbidden? Is it not so clear why it's forbidden? So which do you advise him to do? So this was actually an actual case, Machaneh Chaim of Reb Chaim Sofer, not related to Reb Moshe Sofer, but a student. So he had to deal with that, and he actually thought his Rebbe, the Chasam Sofer, thought umbrellas are really not so forbidden, but we can't allow it. The Machaneh Chaim, the student, thought, no, it's really forbidden, but his Rebbe said it's not so forbidden, so it's a fascinating, how does he end it up? How do you solve those problems? So nowadays, we don't really discuss those questions because it's so settled, it's become settled, that you can't use umbrellas on Shabbos. That is halacha evolving over time. That's one of the essays. So I like to focus on the process of decision making. How is that decision made? How do you apply this ancient halacha to modern life and still retain its meaning? And I believe it is meaningful. And I like to think about the why, not just the what. Not yes, you're allowed, no, you're not allowed. Okay, that has meaning, that guides us because we follow halacha, so we need to know the answers. But why? What meaning does it have? What does it teach us? What do we extract from that? So I think that's fascinating. And I try to do that. I'm not very good at it, but I try. And I'd like to see more people doing that. So here's a question for you. Now, before we go there. So there are two types of books, two types of sfar. There's a svarim that are mechadish, that innovate, that come up with new ideas, that break ground. And there are svarim that are malakit, that organize, that gather together. So there's a cynical view that nowadays we live in an era, a generation, where nobody says anything new, and all they do is gather together what old people have said. There's a halacha about how do you keep Shabbos, so they just go around collecting all the responses, put them all together in one book, in a good order. How do you keep the laws of mourning, Hilchos Avelos. So if you look at the svarim on Hilchos Avelos, those books are really just collections of what other people have said. You gather together a nice book, you sell it, you make some money, you sign some books, everybody's happy, svarim sale, cha-ching, you know, everybody makes money. So that's, I think it's a way exaggerated claim. But here's why I think people make that claim. For better or for worse, most books are forgotten in a year or two. 5-10 years maybe. I remember once speaking to Rabbi Simon way back in the day when I was still a student here, he was still in Mikola. What books are going to remain for eternity? What are posterity? What are people going to remember 100 years from now? What sefer are people going to remember? So here's what he told me. Here's what he thought. He disagrees. He might disagree as well. He's allowed to change his mind. Igros Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's responsa, and Yabia Omer, Rabbi Avadia Yosef's responsa. I think some people were saying Kilos Yaakov, the stipler, his stuff on Gemara. Maybe yes, maybe no. But think about it. So in the past 100 years, what is that, 3 books? So maybe there's more, maybe there's a few more, maybe there's 10. But how many are published a year? If you go, I've been going to this farm sale for 25 years. And every year, there's just a whole new influx of new books, right? New books. So it's just overwhelming. We live in a generation that has witnessed a publishing revolution, literally a publishing revolution. It's very cheap to publish books. So anybody who starts a blog decides to publish a book. It's just rampant books. So a lot of this stuff is going to be forgotten over time. So we see all these lower quality books, and we think, well, they're all bad, but it's not true. There are new, really interesting ideas. So let's say halacha. So if you look at anything Rav Asher Weiss writes, brilliant, innovative, he collects what a lot of other people said, and then he disagrees with them all and comes up with something that's groundbreaking. Fascinating stuff. I have a few of their essays summarizing some of his ideas. Fascinating figure. He's a contemporary. Has anyone here ever heard him speak? Rav Asher Weiss? A few people, yeah. He speaks English well, so it's even better. It's not some Israeli, you know, you have to try to understand the English or the Hebrew. I remember when Rav Adi Yosef came in 1991, I believe, to YU to speak. So I'm blessed that Hebrew as a child, so I could speak it and understand it. My roommate had struggled, and afterwards he asked me, why did Rav Adi Yosef speak in Arabic? He just didn't understand the Hebrew accent of the Middle Eastern Hebrew accent. So Baruch Hashem, Rav Asher Weiss is from America, so you can understand his English, no problem. So what I try to do is I am a malakid, unapologetic. I gathered together what other people said. There is some interesting ways of putting things together. I like to think I do it interestingly. But I don't say anything new. Anything you see in that book, you can find in other places. If you have the library that I happen to have a pretty decent library, so, you know, good luck finding everything. So why should you buy this book when you could just go to my website and read almost everything there? In every book that I publish, I try to put something that is not available online in the book. But the vast majority is available. If you go through the history of the past 4 or 5 years of my website, you'll see almost everything there in the book on the website. So why should you buy the book? So to answer that, I'd like you to take you through a brief history of publishing revolutions, courtesy of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. It's not my framework. So the first revolution in publishing came with pictograms. In prehistory, they started writing with little pictures. So in order to write or read a pictogram, you had to study for decades, because every little picture represented another word. And language has a lot of words. You had to learn all of them. So very, very few people know how to read or write. But it was a way of permanently transferring information. It wasn't just word of mouth. You now had a permanent record. So however many years later, thousands, hundreds of years, I don't know, they came up with the idea of an alphabet. 20 to 30 characters, you could represent an entire language. Still required education, which most people did not have. It was still limited to an elite. But it vastly broke down barriers of communication. Then came the printing press, and everything changed. Again, I skipped probably thousands of years there, but be that as it may. The printing press democratized knowledge, because it put in everybody's hand, just about everybody's hand, not even, many people were illiterate, but every literate person's hand, lots of books. Not just one book, the Bible, many books, because it was much more affordable. A handwritten manuscript, so some people here are married, yeah? So if you have a kesubah, so if you go to the store and you buy one of these, you know, photocopied kesubahs, so it's very cheap. If you go to an engraver or someone with a calligrapher to write you your own kesubah, get ready to take out your checkbook, because it's going to cost you. Beautiful, it's going to cost you. So once I had the printing press, you didn't have to go to a calligrapher, someone to handwrite every book. You could just offset it very quickly. That democratized information. So writing created information. The alphabet spread information. Printing democratized information. And now we have the internet, which is drowning information. Emails, texts, tweets, Instagrams, Snapchats, Facebook updates, texts, WhatsApp messages. It's just overwhelming. I'd be surprised, I'd be very impressed if everybody in this room reads every email they get to the end. I don't. I make sure in business, I'm a journalist. I try to write like a journalist. I put important information up front, because I don't expect anyone to get past the first paragraph. You have to be very motivated, and look, my business emails are not the most exciting things either, but you have to be very motivated to go all the way to the end, and I don't expect most people to. Unless they're looking to find something wrong that I did, then they'll read very carefully. It's just overwhelming. There's so much information that it's not only we don't have time to digest it, We have to read it, digest it, we have to filter it. Is it good, is it bad? And then we have to assign credibility. You know what? Does he know what he's talking about? Yes, no, maybe. It's real reading is a process that takes time. And we don't have that time anymore. So Gemara Sukkah, Daf Lamed Aleph on the base. So a Mishnah. A lulav, right? A palm branch for the holiday of Sukkot to wave. So if it comes from a tree of idolatry, from an Asherah, a lulav shel Asherah is possible. So ask the Gemara why. So Gemara says, Kitusei Michtas Shiure. You need it to be 4 amos big, a lulav. And if it's from a tree of idolatry, it doesn't have that shear. Four tefach. 4 cubits. So you can have 3 to hold it and 1 to shake. Thank you. So it lacks that measurement. Why? Why does it lack that measurement? It's literally physically in my hands. It's an actual palm branch in my hands. Lulav. So Rashi says, because a tree of idolatry and a shera you have to burn. So this lulav is scheduled for incineration. It's on its way out of the world. And therefore, it's as if it doesn't exist. It's fleeting. A lulav shel asherah is fleeting. The internet is kitusei michtas shiura. The internet is fleeting. Now, I don't mean that the internet deserves to be burned, although there probably are some parts of the internet that on some level do. The information you see today, you will not remember tomorrow. The articles you remember today, how often do we say, I saw an article about that last week. I don't remember what it's about, but I think it was important. It's the story of our lives. You can't remember things. So yes, you could read most of this book online. But I guarantee you, you won't. You will not go to the trouble of going through 4 years of archives to find interesting articles. Because there are too many interesting articles in your inbox, on your Facebook feed, in your Twitter feed, etc., etc. So what this book has, people ask me, what? I'm an internet pioneer in the Jewish world. Why would I publish a book? Why not just make an ebook? Why don't I just do something? So the simple answer is because this is real. This is not going to be burned tomorrow. The articles that come in my inbox, if I don't immediately delete them, I'll save them for later, which means never. So this at least has a chance not only of being read, but being maybe even reread. And I have many, many interesting sources in the book that you could then look up from your Sfarim shelf or from the farm sale, or from the Beis Medrash. It is, if you actually read it, and don't take my word for anything, look everything up, you actually will be able to find a lot of things that will remain with you because you can review them. A book is real. It stays on your shelf. So what was the biggest mistake of the conservative movement in Judaism? So I think most people would say the conventional wisdom is their biggest mistake was that they allowed driving to shul on Shabbos. So I think that's totally wrong for 2 reasons. One reason is, I don't know if them allowing people to drive to shul on Shabbos made a difference anyway. People already lived in the suburbs and were driving to shul. It was just giving a stamp of approval. So maybe that was good, maybe that was bad. We can discuss that. Number two, I think their rejection of Torah Misinai, Min HaShamayim, and the Torah Sheba'al Peh, traditionally understood, so I think those are much, much more important, much bigger mistakes than allowing driving at Shabbos. But let's put that aside. Driving was also a problem. So why was it a problem? So number one, it permitted something that's biblically forbidden. Number two, and this is why people say it's such a big problem, is because it allowed the disintegration of communities. If we all live together, and Orthodox Jews live in the same neighborhood, because you have to go to shul, you need a shul, you need a mikvah, you need a pizza shop, you need a Chinese place. So we all live in the same neighborhoods, but if you allow driving at Shabbos, so then people can live whatever they want. They'll drive to shul, they'll drive home, and you don't have that community. You see each other once a week, hopefully, if people make it to shul on Shabbos. Local communities are needed to have a meaningful life. If you want to lead a Torah life, you can't live in the jungle on your own. You need a community. for many reasons. First of all, some mitzvot require a community. But more important than that is socially, we reinforce and we enhance our own religious lives, each other's religious lives. So I could be the biggest tzaddik in the world. Not true, but I could be. But when I go to shul, I help everybody around me. If I happen to be someone who people feel uncomfortable talking in shul around me, it makes them uncomfortable. So just my being there and ignoring them with a sefer open in front of me keeps them from talking in shul. Now, halavai, that would be the case, but if that were the case. But in many other ways, the amen yeheshmei rabba that I say in shul, so other people hear that, and that affects them. And other people, when they say a kaddish, so someone in my shul says a beautiful kaddish with a lot of meaning and very slowly and thinking about every word, so that affects me. And that's just davening, and there are many other ways that we affect each other. So Purim is coming up, so Shalach Manos is on everybody's mind. How do we send, who's on our list that we have to deliver food to on Purim morning as you're rushing from Megillah in the morning to your meal in the afternoon? So who do you go to? So it doesn't really matter. I don't really care. Please don't send to me. I'm mogul. I don't demand anything. But it makes people feel good if you deliver them Shalach Manos on Purim. And it creates a sense of community, a sense of neighbors. So we have the friends, we have the neighbors, we have the people from shul, we have all the obligations. It's why we go crazy on Purim morning trying to deliver to everybody. But it makes a difference because it creates this beauty. Purim is a much more beautiful day because of that. It makes you feel good to be wanted. When I was in Shiva, so what we used to do for Shalach Manos is we get an orange and a bag of potato chips. We get exactly two, right? And so we give to two people, two minim, and there we have Shalach Manos, two people, and we're a yotzei, right? Didn't make anybody feel good. It made us feel good because we're smarter than everybody else because we know how to do it the easiest and cheapest way. But that doesn't really spread joy and like the Purim does. Every holiday spreads joy. And you only really feel that joy when you're living together on the same block, in the same neighborhood, and just overlapping lives. The Ran, the Dor HaFlaga, right? The generation that tried to build the tower up to heaven, and so they were punished. How they were punished by being dispersed. They didn't understand each other's language, and they were dispersed around the world. Around the region. So what did they do wrong? It's not clear what they did wrong. What was their sin? They're trying to build a tower? Is that a sin? Where does it say you're not allowed to build a tower to the sky? So the commentators, they struggle with this. And everybody has all sorts of creative interpretations. Each one is more brilliant than the other. So here's what the Ran says. He was writing in Spain just after the Black Plague. And the community was devastated. All of Europe was devastated. And he gave these sermons that are now in the Drush of Haran to try to elevate and inspire the community. So he says like this. Everybody has good aspects and bad aspects. None of us are perfect. But we all have good parts to it. When we join together, so we complement each other. My good and your good. I might be a good creative thinker. You might be a good implementer. And someone else might be good at this, someone else might be good at that, someone else might be inspiring. I'm not inspiring, I know that, that's okay. And together, as a community, all our different good traits complement each other, and the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. And the same goes for our bad. If we get together to do evil, so I might be a good evil plotter, you might be a good evil implementer, and together we could do a lot of damage. So the Dor HaFlaga, the Ran says, they didn't have a sin. They didn't do anything technically wrong. But they all got together with evil on their mind. And when all these people get together with evil on their mind, God had to disperse them before something terrible happened. So as a community, when we get together, we can do incredible things. Social media is also fleeting. It doesn't create community. If anything, it destroys community if not used properly. We get so caught up on our little phones, we don't notice the people around us. We don't notice our family. We don't notice our neighbors. We don't notice, maybe we don't go to shul as often as we should. Maybe we, even when we are in shul, we're on our phones instead of davening, or at least interacting with people around us. If you think that social media, the Facebook, creates community, you're missing out on what real community is. So social media is not bad. It's actually very good. It exposes you, on the one hand, to diverse perspectives, people living all over the world with all sorts of different opinions. It allows you to do research, to ask questions, to get different views. People with different libraries will give you, you know, people ask for sources. So I just go down to my library and I take pictures and post it on Facebook, and boom, they have the sources that they need. People do that for me as well. You're able to debate, you're able to schmooze. A lot of good things come from there. As well, you can find like-minded people. People who think together, and it turns out you're not the crazy person with no book who everybody disagrees with. You're just living in one community, and there are many people like you all over the world. You just didn't know them, but now you do know them. Social media is great for that, but it doesn't create community. If you aren't careful, it's addictive. It develops bad behaviors in terms of arguing, and I'm guilty as everybody else on both parts. And it risks distracting you from real community. So social media can be used responsibly if you use it as an add-on to real life. If you use it in addition to community, then it can actually enhance not only your own experience, but the entire community can be enhanced. This is being live fed on Facebook, so anybody who is bored in this afternoon can watch this. So on an individual level, social media can expand your community, but it shouldn't replace your community. So now let's talk in the remaining few minutes that we have about a little social media and halacha. Posting pictures to social media, is that allowed? So obviously, it should go without saying, you should not post anything to social media that is sexually suggestive in any way. And that includes people in various levels of undress. Even if it's considered okay to walk around the streets of Manhattan that way, we have higher standards than that. As well, you have to follow all the relevant copyright laws. I don't endorse violating that. Photographers deserve to earn a living. But let's move beyond that. So this is a college campus, right? Now this happens to be a great college campus where no one ever does anything stupid. But let's say there's a college campus exists somewhere in the country where college students might be doing something stupid at any time. Whether they're inebriated or not, it doesn't really matter. So everybody has a phone, everybody can take a picture, everybody can post it to social media like that. That's not allowed. The Gemara in Bava Metzia compares embarrassing someone to bloodshed. It's like murder. How is it like murder? In many ways it can be. In many ways it can actually lead to, well, in general, we see in society, I mean, it's terrible, it's tragic, but misuse of social media leads people to commit suicide. And we see right there the truth of the Gemara, that embarrassing someone is like murder. So what I'm not saying is you can't be playful and you can't tease people. That's perfectly allowed. I tease people and I'm playful as well. You have to know the line. And there's no solid psak, halacha, this is the line, you're allowed to post and this you're not allowed to post. You have to use your common sense. And if you don't have common sense, find someone who does and ask him, is this going to embarrass somebody? But you should not want to embarrass anyone in your family, your kids. I'm a big believer, I never post any pictures of my kids online, because I don't want to embarrass them. And they're not yet ready to give me permission for that. And I disagree with a lot of people who do that, including my own siblings, who post pictures of their kids. And I don't allow that whatsoever. My kids, you won't know their names. I've been on the internet for many years. You won't know my kids' names. You won't know their, might know their ages. One kid was born while I had a blog, and so I blogged about him being born on Shabbos. But other than that, you won't know their names, their ages, any of their life cycle events, and you won't even know what they look like, because they don't want that. When my daughter got engaged, she specifically said, no pictures, no mention online. Funny story, though. a few months ago, my daughter gave birth. And I had a picture, obviously, from the hospital. And I sent it to a bunch of friends. And one of my friends is a publisher of a newspaper. So he didn't realize I would have objected to this. Obviously, he wouldn't do it without an attempt to make me feel uncomfortable, but he published a mazel tov with a picture of my granddaughter in the newspaper when all these years I've struggled to keep my kids out of the media and out of the internet. So hopefully she won't be embarrassed by the baby picture. So not only are you not allowed to embarrass people, it's more than that. You're not allowed to be hurtful. Hurtful pictures. So anyone here know how to use Photoshop or any of those type of things? It's very easy. You take a picture of someone, and you can move their faces, put all sorts of hurtful words on there, interesting words. You could use a filter. It's very easy to distort pictures and make people look silly and ridiculous. And that could hurt people's feeling, could damage their reputation. It's really bullying. Bullying is not allowed ever. So it's devarim. So the Mishnah says, Onaz Devarim, Velosonu Ishus Abiso, it's a pasuk, you're not allowed to in any way hurt somebody. And that means through words. So you might think, Onaz Devarim, Devarim means words, you're not allowed to hurt people through words. But that's not true. Any form of causing pain to somebody is considered Onaz Devarim. Emotional pain. You're not allowed to cause emotional pain. And now we're not, look, I'm the last person, on one hand, I'm not Ben Shapiro. On the other hand, I don't think we have to cater to everybody's, you know, insecurities and just use common sense. Don't make anybody feel bad. You don't have to be political. I'm not politically correct. You know, if the video camera wasn't on, I'd be even less politically correct. But there's a line between just acting normal and interacting with people and just being a jerk. And the basic rule of halacha is don't be a jerk. It's really not that hard. That's not what I wanted to talk about. So let's say I'm in a restaurant with my wife. I take a picture of her. And there are people in the background. Can I post that to Instagram? Without getting permission of the people. So obviously I need my wife's permission. And the truth is she wouldn't give me that permission. But let's say she would give me that permission. Do I need the permission of the people in the background? So let me tell you why you do. Let's say sitting in the background is someone on a job interview. And he doesn't want his boss to know that he's looking for another job. You post that online, a friend of yours as a friend somehow gets to his boss. He could be out of a job. You could have caused someone to lose their job by posting that picture. So let's say, let's not talk about a job, two people on a date. But one is a Hatfield, one is a McCoy. And they're not ready yet to publicize their romance. And you do it for them. You could destroy their family without getting their permission by posting that picture online. It says in Proverbs, the Mishlei, Holech Rachel Megala Sod. If you reveal a secret, it's just the same as Lashon Hara, as gossip, as tale-bearing. But is it halachically allowed? Let's get technical. So about 100 years ago, when does photography started? In the 1860s, I think? So let's say somewhere around then. So there were some people who felt that it was improper, mystically, to take a picture of somebody. It's like you're taking their soul and putting it on a piece of paper. And they were very uncomfortable with it. Al-Pi Kabbalah. There were famous rebbes who we don't have pictures of because they didn't want their picture taken. There's a halacha that we're not allowed to hold in our position, we're not allowed to own something that could be used for idolatry. So the standard opinion is that anything three-dimensional, so we cannot have a three-dimensional copy of, even if it was never worshipped, so full cows, because some people somewhere worship cows, we can't have a three-dimensional cow in our house, even if it's clear you didn't make it. There is an opinion, the Ramban says, even a two-dimensional picture of a cow or a person, you're not allowed to own. So a Barbie doll is actually a shayla. And the answer is yes, you're allowed to own dolls, because they're treated disrespectfully, you schlep them around, and nobody would schlep around on the floor an idol, so that's a leniency that's available for baby's dolls. Let's say you have a really nice figurine of a human being. So that is an idol, even if never worshipped, and you should not own that. So the Ramban says not only three-dimensional, but two-dimensional as well. So I once asked for a five coin. I used to daven in a shul. Five coin is a very well-known halachic authority offered the Badei HaShulchan. You can buy some of his books downstairs. So I asked him, should I be strict? I was under Kol at the time. Should I be strict for this Ramban and not have any two-dimensional pictures of full human beings? And he said to me, Gil, but how could we own encyclopedias if we follow that Ramban? I thought that was funny, because I don't own encyclopedias. Anyone here own encyclopedias? Different generation, previous generation. But still, some people might want to be strict for that Ramban and not want their picture to be on a piece of paper, on the internet. Some people think the internet is all usher, it's all forbidden, so they don't want their picture up there. So are you allowed to take the picture? So Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, he was a Rav of Yerushalayim way back when, early 1900s. So he said, I don't care if people don't want their pictures taken. You're allowed to take it. If you think it's permissible, you could take their picture even without their permission. Menashe Klein, right? He lived in Bauer Park until recently. He passed away maybe within the past 5-10 years. So he disagreed. He thought it's not allowed for a number of reasons. First of all, let's say someone will take his own picture, but he doesn't want you to take his picture. So from the Kabbalistic view that mystically somehow taking a picture of someone is hurting them, so he's allowed to hurt himself, doesn't mean you're allowed to hurt him. I could, you know, whatever, I could punch myself in the face. Doesn't mean you could. Everyone in the room could come over and take turns punching me in the face. It doesn't work that way. Everybody has to get their own unique permission to punch me in the face, as well as taking a picture of someone. That's his argument. Additionally, he says, you could sell the picture, right? So I could take my own picture, and I could sell it. Probably not for much, I'm not a model, but let's say I was some good-looking, or some famous rabbi, some Hasidic rabbi, people would pay money for my pictures. I could take it, I could sell it. If you take my picture, so you're taking that money away from me that I could have made. That's his argument, why he says you're not allowed to take a picture of someone without getting their permission. So Shlomo Aviner disagrees. He thinks, number one, causing future profit that may or may not come, it's not really a loss. That's very indirect. Number one. And number two, he says there's a very simple reason you're not allowed to take someone's picture without their permission. Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. You have to love your fellow as yourself. Or as Hillel says, don't do unto others as you don't want done to yourself. If you don't want your picture taken without your permission, so don't take someone else's picture without their permission. Therefore, says Rav Aviner, for basic reasons of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, you cannot take a picture of someone else without their permission. And you cannot post their picture without their permission, because aside from the damage you could do, you wouldn't want that damage done to yourself. So if you would demand permission before someone posts your picture online, you have to give someone else that courtesy as well. So I want to leave time for questions and for a book signing, and we're pretty much out of time right now. But I just want to close with one thought. So, lost my train of thought, so that is not going anywhere. So let me close with something else. This book is about halacha, right? And I said before that I care a good deal about the why of halacha. Why do we have to do certain things? And what can, more than that, what can we learn from the various laws that came over time and have developed over time? So the Rambam, they say this in the name of Reb Chaim, but I really think the Rambam says it himself. Tamei ha-mitzvos, the reasons that we do mitzvos, what are the reasons underlying all these laws that we have? So we call them in Hebrew tamei ha-mitzvot, tamei ha-mitzvos, and Reb Chaim points out, tam literally means taste. These are tastes of the commandments. So what does that mean? Divine wisdom. The underlying reason that Hashem commanded all these laws, we will never know that. For many reasons. The least of which is that we're human and we're frail and we're flawed. And we're biased and we will never be able to fully access that divine wisdom. So, but still, the Rambam devotes most of the third part of Mor HaNevuchim to trying to explain Tamei HaMitzvah. So why is that the case? So Reb Chaim, and I believe the Rambam says this himself, explains as follows. A tam, a taste, changes from person to person. I might like something, you might not like it. You might like something else. It's very subjective. The mitzvos, the commandments, lie in divine wisdom, but we can all find our own meaning, our own reasons for these commandments that resonate with us. So when the Rambam suggests, for example, that Shatnez, why is Shatnez Asr? Because the ancient idolatrous priests wore Shatnez, and therefore we're not allowed to wear it as well. So does that resonate with you? Maybe yes, maybe no. It actually does resonate with me. What I try to do in this book is to give my own Ta'ame HaMitzvos, not to the big commandments, but to the little halachas, the little yeses and noes, the little don't do this on Shabbos, are you allowed to open the wrapper, you're not allowed to open the wrapper. I believe there's meaning to that, and I try to find the meaning in there. But it's all very subjective. It's really, you know, I'm not really qualified to offer many intelligent opinions, but I can tell you what my personal tastes are, and that's what I try to do, and I try to get the discussion going. As I started, I'm really a blogger, that's where I come from, and it's all about starting the conversation. So, Yes Hashem, this book should start the conversation and should start you thinking and coming up with your own ideas as well. So thank you everyone for coming and for listening, and if anyone has any questions, you can ask now, or you can ask later, and we'll sign books as well.